Well, I was out of the office this week. I didn't get the memo on the sandals or flip-flops. I'm wearing shoes, so that's probably a good thing for you that I'm wearing shoes. We'll spare you that. We are in week three of our Poverty Who Cares series. Pastor Doug is out of town today. He'll return next week to wrap up this series. And today, we look at one of the most eye-opening things when it comes to poverty, at least for myself, and that is how the time and the energy and the money that we spend trying to help those in poverty can actually hurt. And so today's message is a bit different, and I want to start with maybe a few details or even disclaimers as we get started. There are two parts to this message. The first part is how our helping causes problems we didn't anticipate or expect. The second part will then offer solutions to make our helping more effective and better received. And I've asked Jessie Copeland, she's our outreach elder here at Hillcrest and a longtime friend of mine, to tag team this message with me. And I'm going to cover the problems, the first part, because I've made a lot of mistakes in the helping part of it. And since, frankly, Jessie's a lot more experienced and better at this than I am, she's going to come on up and talk about solutions. And some of this is tough to hear. And you're going to maybe hear some of these things, and you're going to maybe want to argue or disagree, or it's going to make you upset, and that's okay. Because I've been there, and I'm still learning and still trying to work through how our helping can hurt. And so our expectation today isn't that, you know, this message or even this series is going to transform your thinking overnight. But hopefully we plant some seeds that will bring about some lasting change and making sure that when we help people in poverty, we're doing it in a way that's effective and long-lasting. All right, enough of the disclaimers. If you got a program with you, there's some fill-ins. Those fill-ins go along with what Jesse's going to be talking about. But there's five ways that our helping hurts people. And the first way is our helping patronizes people. It looks down on them. A good definition for patronize is to treat people in a way that is apparently kind or helpful, but betrays a feeling of superiority. And so a lot of the good that we do for the poor is in apparently kind ways. We serve at the banquet, and we pack backpacks, and we give money, and we donate time, and we travel to third world countries to build homes and churches and orphanages. And all that activity is good, and it's kind, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's how we try to live out Jesus' words in Matthew 25 about doing unto the least of these, or in Acts chapter 1 when he says, be my witnesses to Jerusalem and to Judea and Samaria and to all the ends of the world. Those efforts are our obedience to what Jesus and to what Scripture is calling us to do, but often the help that we give is done with an aura of superiority. We don't purposefully do this. It's not intentional. But how we behave and how we help unintentionally communicates superiority, because oftentimes our giving and our doing is doing things for people that they can do themselves. I have a lot of stories I could share where I have done something for someone that they could have done themselves. But I'm going to pick on our trip to Pine Ridge a few years ago. 2014, I took a team from here to Pine Ridge. And on the surface, it was a disaster of a trip. If you're on that trip with me, you're already smiling. About a week before we were to leave, we were to go to Pine Ridge and do the typical mission trip thing. We're going to do some vacation Bible school type stuff, do some home maintenance, some home repair, and, you know, feel really good about what we were doing. And about a week before we were to leave, we got a call that says, all that stuff that you had planned to do is not going to be able to be done. Awesome. So, you know, there's a team of 28 of us, several adults taking time off from work and have paid money. And so, you know, we need to do something. And so I hit the phones, and Jesse helped me contact some people, and we found some things that we could do. We found a part of Pine Ridge where we could mow some lawns, and there was a community park that needed some lawn mowing, and so we were going to do that, and hopefully we're going to serve a meal and have the people from the community come out and do that. And I thought we had a good plan, and I thought day one went pretty good. And on our way back from lawn mowing and hanging out with the locals, we stopped at a gas station in Pine Ridge to get something cold to drink. And this lady saw us. We were in our matching shirts, you know, because that's how you do these missions trip things. We were in our matchy-matchy shirts. And this lady came up to us and just started laying into us, saying things like, "We don't need you here. And we're fine. And we can take care of ourselves." And my initial response was, "No, you can't, because look around." Okay? That's not real Jesus-y, is it? But after the anger and kind of my shock, you know, waned, I heard what she was saying. And what she was saying is, you know, you're doing work that we can do ourselves. We might not be doing it, but we are capable of doing it. And it was hard to argue. I mean, every lawn that we mowed, there were able-bodied men and women looking on from their homes or from their porches, watching us mow their lawn. And our mowing of the lawn was patronizing. It was being superior, because in our middle-class culture, a mowed lawn is a value. You can get in trouble in Sioux Falls and in your community if you don't mow your lawn. And if the social shame doesn't get you to mow your lawn, the city or neighborhood will enforce that for you. But that's not a value over at Pine Ridge. You can look around and no one's mowing their lawn. There's not much lawn to mow. And so the lawn mowing was something that we created so that we could justify our time and our effort being on this trip. But I'm sure that lawn didn't get mowed again until another group came and needed something to do. And Jess is going to share a little bit more about some of those differences between our cultures when it comes to helping the poor. Secondly, our helping causes shame. If it's not bad enough to do something the recipient is able to do for themselves, sometimes our helping actually causes the recipient to feel worse about who they are and their condition. I know there's different definitions of shame. When I talk about shame, I talk about shame being feeling bad for who you are or for the situation that you're in. And I don't think people in poverty need to feel worse about who they are or the condition they're in. I don't think they need to feel worse about their lack of resources or about the fact that their children can't afford to do certain things. I'm going to pick on a popular way that we help people in poverty, but also one that causes shame, and that is the angel trees that we see each and every Christmas season. And we used to do angel tree here, and on the surface, again, on the surface, there's nothing wrong with an angel tree. You have a tree, you know, or a bulletin board or something at work or at the mall, and you take a tag off and you buy a gift and you wrap it up and maybe you deliver it, maybe someone else delivers it for you, and you feel great about doing something in the holiday season for someone who is under-resourced. But if you've been at Hillcrest for a while, I know that several of you have delivered those gifts because I've been with you. And the last time that we delivered it, we couldn't do it anymore. Because we brought gifts to this family, to this home, in a really run-down part of town. And if you're like me, you're feeling excited, right? You're feeling like, hey, we're doing our part, you know, woohoo, Merry Christmas. And the first sign that things went wrong is when the one kid complained that she didn't have as many gifts as her brother. Now, I don't know about you, but the whole, well, we spent the same, doesn't work. Doesn't work in middle class. Doesn't work in my home. Doesn't work in people in poverty. She saw brother had three gifts. She had two. It didn't matter that the amount was the same. There's already this. Ugh. And then as we're delivering the gifts, we see, you know, dad or caregiver or uncle or someone, and he's kind of peeking out of the hallway. And he feels, I mean, if you could have a visual of what shame looks like, he felt horrible. Because here we were bringing gifts that he couldn't provide, or that he couldn't have the resources to provide, and making him and whoever else was in that home feel worse about their situation. Again, well-meaning, but missing the mark. And Pastor Doug in this series has been talking about a verse from 1 John through the Message. We're going to look at a different one here from 1 Peter, but also from the Message. And Eugene Peterson translates it like this. He says, "It is God's will that by doing good, you might cure the ignorance of the fools who think you're a danger to society. Exercise your freedom by serving God, not by breaking the rules." And so we want to affirm all the good that we are called to do and that we are doing. Nothing wrong with the good that we are up to. But the last sentence here, treat everyone you meet with dignity. And that's where I have some learning to do. Because oftentimes that giving and that serving and that helping that we do is done for the person, whether they want it or not, and isn't really having that person's dignity in mind. And Jess is going to talk more about that when she comes up here as well. Number three, our helping wastes money. Our helping sometimes wastes money. So in Luke 15, Jesus tells three stories of lost things. The first parable is a lost sheep. The second one's about a lost coin. The third parable is about a lost son. In each of those parables, the lost item is found, and there is much rejoicing and celebrating over that lost thing that's been found. And in the first one, there's 100 sheep. This shepherd owns 100 sheep. 99 of them are safe. They're in the pen or what have you. But one is missing. And so that shepherd leaves the 99 to go and search for the one that is missing. And when he finds the one sheep, he brings it back, and they're celebrating and rejoicing. And Jesus kind of uses that to talk about how when one lost person is found, that there's much celebrating in heaven. And in at least in church work, that's given way to what I call, and to what Pastor Doug calls, the just one person fallacy. And so the just one person argument goes like this. Look, if just one person is impacted, if just one person responds or is saved or is restored or makes a change, if just one person replies or responds to the way that we had designed, then whatever money and time and energy and resources we spent made it all worth it. And Pastor Doug and I have been doing ministry long enough together that we would both say this. We would both say, really? Is it really worth it? I mean, and I'm not putting the price on a soul. Don't hear that. And it's kind of funny that Jesse's helping me teach this morning, because 17 years ago when I was a youth pastor and she was a high school senior, we had a little bit of a email conflict over this idea. We're better now, so it's all good. But in youth ministry, if you put on a retreat and hundreds of students come, and you spend tens of thousands of dollars, and you utilize hundreds of hours of volunteers, and only one person is impacted, whatever that impact is, was it really worth it? Or could you have had the same impact and spent that money and that time and that energy in a different way? I think the same principle holds true for those in poverty. If we look at my Pine Ridge trip, I think 28 of us went on that trip. I think the average cost was about $100. And so that's $2,800 that it cost us to go to Pine Ridge. That doesn't factor in the time that adults took off from work. And I don't want to keep ragging on this trip, because it was a great experience to live life with Hillcresters on a day-to-day basis in Pine Ridge. And to this day, those of you that know Phil Bell, I don't think I saw him this morning, but those of you that know Phil Bell, you know, during that trip, we learned that Phil didn't like the song Radioactive by Imagine Dragons. It was a big song 5 years ago. And so we kind of gave him some grief over that. And to this day, when I hear that song on the radio, or when he hears that song on the radio, we text each other, Radioactive. Okay? Now, that doesn't happen, you know, if we're not living life together and going to Pine Ridge. But I'm not sure that we even broke even in the amount of value that we generated for that community. And we look at $2,800, could that money that we spent had more impact if we donated it to a nonprofit that's doing work on Pine Ridge? Or what if we gave a scholarship to a high school senior from Pine Ridge so that he or she could get a degree, get off the res, and turn her and her family's life around? Or what if we supported a local pastor or a local teacher or a local coach, someone that's in the trenches doing good work day in and day out? And what if we gave that money to them? I think, you know, you get the idea that sometimes our best intentions waste money, waste time, waste resources. Four, our helping sometimes, or our helping can create new problems. Sometimes we solve one problem, but then we create a bunch of other problems that wouldn't have existed if we just wouldn't have done anything to begin with. Here, I'll give you a kind of a stereotypical example. If a first world country, or if an American looks at a third world country or a third world part of the world and says, you know what, you would do really well in agriculture if you just had some equipment. And so what we're going to do is we're going to fundraise for you. We're going to get you a tractor and get you a truck and maybe a combine. And we're going to give you all this new equipment. And that way you can farm like we farm here in the States and grow your own food and maybe bring it to market and sell it and make money. And boom, your poverty is taken care of. And instead, what we do is we give them more problems because we don't know what to do, or they don't know what to do when the tractor breaks down, or when they need an implement, or if the closest source of diesel is 1 to 2 hours away, what then? So you've given them this beautiful piece of equipment, and then 2 or 3 years when you go back over there to check on how things are going, you see that truck or that tractor rusting away in a field, and you are really mad. Can't believe it. We wasted all this time and all this money, and you're not even grateful. Of course they're not grateful, because we solved maybe one problem. We gave them 5, 10 more. It's not their fault. It's ours. We thought we were doing good, and we instead created more problems. Finally, at least for us this morning, is our helping doesn't challenge systems. I know in this series, in the first couple of weeks, Pastor Doug has been talking about systems and how sometimes the systems that we design or that we are implementing can keep people in poverty, or at least we're not addressing how they might be impacting those in poverty. And in Luke chapter 10, Jesus tells the well-known parable of the Good Samaritan. And for most of us, the parable of the Good Samaritan is a check. It's a test on how you love your neighbor and who your neighbor really is. And it's meant to inspire you and I to not be like the busy religious people in the parable who step, you know, away or across and don't help out the guy that had been beaten up, but to be like the Samaritan and then despise the lowly, the outcast Samaritan and take time and energy and resources and help your neighbor. But there's another way to look at the parable. What I just reminded the first verse of it, Jesus says this, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, they beat him, and they went away, leaving him half dead. Now, when the audience would have heard that a guy was going from Jerusalem to Jericho, they knew the route he was taking was bad. It was notorious for crime. It's not surprising that this guy got beat up on that pathway from Jerusalem to Jericho. That's not the surprising part of the parable. And so another way for us to think about that is, why was the road bad to begin with? How can our helping attack the system or the conditions that created the possibility that this guy was going to get beat up to begin with? What could we have done to make it better? Was there a lack of resources? Was there a dishonest government? Was there a war, a threat of war? Was there a lack of a private partner to come in and to clean up that area, to partner with to clean up that area? And so similarly, our helping often stops short of challenging systems and of asking difficult questions and of considering what are the best ways to help those who are under-resourced. And so to kind of tag in here at this point, I want to invite Jessie to the stage. She's going to take it from here and talk about solutions.
Good morning. I'm honored to be here today. I typically like to stand behind that piano if I'm up here, or at least talk to little people. So here I am. I had to chuckle a little bit as I prepared for this, as I also feel like I just have messed up 100 times before I've figured this out or gotten anything right. But I've been working with people in poverty over the last 10 plus years. And so as a result of that, I've kind of been able to gain some perspective and just kind of a framework of what makes sense and what can work because I've messed up. So here, I'm going to share just a result of my experience over these years. So I'm going to start with a story about my first job. I was fresh out of college. I was 22. I was standing on this stage in tears. I was going to drive out to Detroit and leave my family and leave my church family. I grew up here. And I was pretty excited but terrified. And so I drove out there for 2 days to inner city Detroit. And when I got there the next morning, I found myself on the doorstep of a family that would be in my school, in my class, in the next few weeks. I was with the director. I kind of stood nervously behind him, and he knocked on the door, and this woman named Sandra came to the door, and there was 9 kids in this home. There was no dads, no adults. And he said, "I see you're getting evicted." There was a dumpster in her driveway, which was the sign, I learned later. And he said, "We can take your kids. We can put you up in a hotel for a while, but we cannot take your things." Their house was full of cockroaches, and so that was not an option. And she didn't like that answer, and so she shut the door, and we walked away. My eyes about came out of my head. I was like, "We're just going to walk away? I mean, there's 9 kids in here. Where are they going to go? What are they going to do?" And we did walk away. And I remember thinking, like, maybe I'm not cut out for this. And maybe, but I have no clue what I'm doing here. I don't know why they did this. And so I learned over that time that they had rules in place and they had a process in place so that they wouldn't continue to hurt and perpetuate the situation with this family and several other families in our school. And so 10 years later, I can tell you my heart still breaks in a lot of these situations. I hope it always does. But I have gained a little perspective, and I have some best practices and some rules in place that can help as we change lives and continue to break chains in poverty. So I don't think I have the answers, and I don't think that there's a definite solution, but I do think there's some questions we can ask as we take steps to make change. So first things first, our helping needs to know the rules. I would guess a large majority of you here today have seen people asking for money with an iPhone in their hand, and you might get a little angry about that. You might see a mom who has a fresh manicure asking for diapers for her child. You might see them turn down donations or a gift that wasn't good enough for them. This is where the hidden rules of poverty come into play loud and clear. There's a book by Ruby K. Payne called The Framework of Understanding Poverty. I highly recommend this book. I read this early on in my career and really was the foundation for starting this line of work. I won't get into all the rules of this or all the nuts and bolts, but it really helps you develop a framework and understanding of where these people are coming from. In poverty, people function based on a different set of rules than you and me. They, for example, view money as what's in the present. So if they have $20 in their hand, they're going to go get a manicure. They might not know what they're going to eat that night, and they might not have clothes for their kids, but they have $20 right now, which is why you see the mom with the manicure. Even better, they might take that $20 and go to the local rental shop, which is conveniently located in low-income neighborhoods, and put money down on a flat-screen TV and put that in their home. And they still might not know what they're eating for dinner, but they'll worry about that later. That's absurd to us. We don't function that way. That's not how our rules work. We're thinking about next week, and we're thinking about 5 years. We're thinking about retirement, and that's not how the world works when you're living in poverty. They're making decisions and functioning based on surviving the current moment, not tomorrow, not next week, and certainly not retirement. If we come in with our world and we try to place it in theirs, it's not going to fit. Understanding where they're coming from and understanding what they value and making them feel valued will go a long way in making any sort of change. It's not a quick fix, and building relationships is messy, and it can make you angry and hurt, and oftentimes throw your hands up, like, "I don't understand," and that's okay. Last summer, I was recruiting for a preschool that I would be starting in the fall in downtown Sioux Falls. I visited the homeless shelters frequently. I was trying to get moms and families to sign their kids up, fill out all the paperwork, and I'd gone several times to one of the shelters downtown, and there was a mom there in a recliner on her phone almost every time I got there, and she had 2 little kids playing at her feet, and it was quick for me to judge and think, "What are you doing? Why are you not at least looking for a job or playing with your kids or something, you know, other than just sitting here in the homeless shelter?" And so after 3 or 4 visits, she finally said hello to me. She filled out the paperwork, and I had to refrain from offering her a few applications for jobs as well and offering some ideas to work with her kids and just be glad that she was making the step in the future for signing up her kids for preschool. And in her opinion, she was doing well. Her kids were happy. She had a place to sleep. She knew where she was going to go for dinner. And so we just had to take those baby steps to get in the right direction. And I'll tell more of her story later. So there are three questions we need to ask when we're helping people. The first one is our helping even wanted? Instead of stepping in and saving the day, we need to make sure that they want help. If they don't, you'll be spinning your wheels every time. One way you can do this is by offering options and resources, making them make the choice, making them take the action. This is really hard for me sometimes, especially when kids are involved. It's hard for me not to just take care of the situation so that a child doesn't suffer as a result. I want them to want it more than they want it, and that doesn't work. They have to want it more than you, and they have to make that decision and provide ownership, or it won't be successful. If you're familiar with the Genesis Project, through the Sioux Falls Ministry Center, they model this really well. Several times last year, I called them regarding certain families and situations, and what I wanted to do was sign them up, make their appointment, drive them to the appointment, take them in, and the Genesis Project won't let you do that. They say, please give them our phone number. And so then the family has to call, and the family has to make that appointment and take that first step to get in there. And there's some that do, and there's many that don't, and that's frustrating in our world, but for them, they have to be able to want to make that step. I had another mom who desperately needed a job. She had several kids, and, you know, you have to work in our world. And she kept telling me every time there's no place hiring. And if you drive down 12th Street for 5 blocks, you know there's a place hiring. And so I just had to let it go and stop trying to give her applications, and I had to make sure that she was going out to find a job, and she eventually did when she wanted to and on her time. The next question is, does our helping preserve a person's dignity? Like Brian shared earlier with the Pine Ridge story, we don't need to go in and be the saviors and bring our agenda and be serving really for ourselves. We have to ask ourselves, are we preserving the person's dignity, and do we have the right attitude as we do it? Are we trying to save the day? Are we trying to make ourselves feel better, or are we trying to help someone else and make their life better, empowering them through it? Brian also mentioned the Angel Tree. Again, not a bad program, but last Christmas, I was able to be involved with a program at the Ministry Center as well. It was a Christmas store, and so families were referred down there through various agencies and qualifications, and they were able to go shopping. And when you walked in, there was a store with toys and games and bikes and books and clothes and arts and crafts, and these families were able to go shopping at 90% off the price. So for 10% of the cost of a bike, they could buy their kids a bike. And they knew this all going in. It was all set up. And so for the first time for some of these parents, they walked in and shopped for their kids. And they picked out things that their kids would like, things that they wanted to give their kids, and then they wrapped them up and they gave their kids gifts. And that was a just a beautiful model of preserving their dignity and making them feel proud to provide Christmas for their families in a really thoughtful and very tangible, meaningful, possible way. I'm also privileged to work for another organization in Sioux Falls called the Sioux Falls Hope Coalition. This started as a group of people that sat down and said, how can we make some change? What would work? What would matter? How can we get the most bang for our buck? And so this is the third year in existence for this program, and they offer scholarships for preschool. And so this year they'll be providing 150 scholarships for children to attend preschool. Preschool is not free in South Dakota. It's one of 8 states in our country that doesn't offer early childhood education, which is vital in starting school. And so these kids will go to school, preschool, for one or two years, and then they'll go to school ready. And they'll enter the education system on a level playing field, and they'll be able to be ready to start kindergarten rather than constantly fighting to catch up. The next question is our helping developmental? One of the hardest parts of doing this work is seeing kids suffer at the hands of poor people, or at poor decisions by their parents. Oftentimes, this is when we bend the rules for the sake of a child, but we have to think about, are we making steps that are developmentally appropriate? You don't see people raising money to send grandma to medical school, because that's not appropriate, right? It wouldn't make sense for a 40-year-old single mom to say, I'm going to be a doctor, and so they start their first year of college. It does make sense for a 40-year-old single mom to go to a program to become a CNA, and there's programs in Sioux Falls that will pay for that training for a mom to become a CNA, and then she could go on to nursing school from there. As a result, maybe her child would go to college and be the first one in their family to graduate from college. If you remember, several years back, we operated the Powerhouse Tutoring Center here at Hillcrest. That was birthed out of a need for middle school students to have a place to go after school. So they had an elementary program, they graduated from that, and these kids didn't have someone have relationships in their life or mentors or people helping them with homework or even just, you know, saying hello or playing ping pong or doing those things. So there was a dedicated crew of people that came over every week and hung out with these kids and walked with them through those middle school years and hopefully invested, planted some seeds in them. I ran into a mom last summer of one of the students who said her son was getting ready to take off for a internship at an acting school in college or in California, and he was hoping to attend there in the next year. So I'm not saying that Powerhouse was the savior, but it was a seed that was planted and a step in the right direction. The key to all of this and the one big takeaway that I hope you're hearing today is that our helping needs to happen through relationships. The support systems in the lives of those living in poverty are often not helping them take steps out of poverty. Under-resourced people need mentoring on middle-class rules. I gave you a glimpse of the hidden rules of poverty, but there's hidden rules in the middle class and upper class as well. For example, we are concerned about the quality of our food, what's in our food, not just if we have enough. We use our $20 not to get a manicure, maybe sometimes, but to get our oil changed so that down the road we don't have a $2,000 repair and no way to get to work. We also stand in lines to sign up our kids for school and have them prepared to attend kindergarten. This is the knowledge that you have. You didn't work for it, you didn't pay for it, you grew up in it, and you possess a huge key in this world. We have to teach these middle class rules that are basic survival skills in our society. They are a step out of poverty, and they are not something they possess or have access to. It's not that they often don't want better for their family. They just don't always know how to take the first step to get there. Generational poverty means there's 3 to 4 to 5 years of this perpetual cycle of those living in poverty. Another big part of Sioux Falls, if you are in the community at all, you recognize all the number of different cultures that are prevalent. You can imagine moving from a village in Africa or a city in East Asia, beyond the language barrier alone, just the shock of living in an American culture and just the learning curve that that brings with it. When I taught English in the public school system, there was a family from South Sudan in Juba, where I had been a few years prior, that had a bit of a stigma surrounding them in the school. And I needed to make a home visit over there, and the sheriff said, "Do you want me to go with you?" And I was like, "Yeah, I lived in Detroit, I'm good." And so I got over there, and I was greeted as I expected. It was very cold, I wasn't invited in, and I barely got what I needed, and I had to make several visits over there, and lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah. So as I was there longer, things changed. And every time I was there, though, I noticed the smoke detectors beeping, chirping. And eventually I was, you know, greeted with hugs. Sometimes mom came in her bathrobe to the door. That's always fun. I would always have to leave my car running, so they knew I, you know, I couldn't stay very long. And so the next time I went, I grabbed a pack of batteries. And when I got over there, I showed the dad where the smoke detectors were and what you had to do. And so we walked around and changed the batteries and explained, you know, they didn't have smoke detectors in their hut in Africa. And so we were able to take care of that issue. And so I didn't go into that having studied for hours or reading the manual of the smoke detector. I just knew from growing up in the middle class that you had to change the batteries. And so these are the hidden rules that we take for granted for and things that we need to teach and things that we don't even know that we need to share. There are a lot of easy and safe ways to get to know an adult in need in Sioux Falls and families. I can think of several right now that I could give you the phone number to. Someone that just needs a mentor and someone to walk alongside them. This is obviously a perk of my job. I can already hear many of you thinking, this doesn't happen in my work, or nope, this isn't possible in my life, but I promise it can. And it doesn't have to be big, it doesn't have to be scary, it doesn't even have to take a lot of time. Maybe you cut hair. This is a privilege that often goes by the wayside for a lot of kids. Maybe you're really good at budgeting, and you want me to give you the phone number of a mom who's going to lose her apartment if she doesn't get things figured out. Maybe you speak English. You could teach the letters. You could teach the fruit in the grocery ad. You could teach them how to say hello, how to call and make an appointment. If you could muster the courage to sit next to a mom who just needs a little time and a little relationship with someone to get her on her feet. It's relationships that are the key to help them take the steps out of poverty. Someone that you will step into relationship with, take them under your wing, and cheer them on. I have to give a bit of a disclaimer, though. Our white middle-class rules are pretty systematic, pretty black and white. You know, you make steps forward. Sure, you might mess up a little bit, but you're constantly moving forward. But it's not always that way when you're working with people living in poverty. And I've had my fair share of disappointments and frustrations, even anger. The mom that I worked with last summer in the homeless shelter, we got her into an apartment, and she got a job. We had a pizza party on the floor. It was exciting. And within about 2 months, she had lost that apartment. So we got into the next apartment, and she dressed up in the Statue of Liberty on 10th Street and waved. She found all these jobs so she could keep this apartment. And I found out a couple months ago, she lost that apartment and left town and blocked me out of her life. She cut off communication for us. And so I could get angry, and it might even be righteous, because I feel like I spent a lot of time with her, but I just have to remember that there were seeds planted and that there were steps taken forward. And hopefully in this time, as she maybe took a few too many steps back, that she remembers those things to step forward and to continue to make progress and positive steps in her life. So my last question is, where can you find a person to be in relationship with? And what can you offer? What is the first step that you will take? I'm going to give a quick shameless plug again for the Immersion Day on Saturday, July 27th. We're going to be in downtown Sioux Falls in various ministries, walking with people in poverty and serving in a couple areas. And I would love to have more of you do that with us. Sign up and join us on that day in Sioux Falls. So to end the story from the beginning, the family in Detroit that was getting evicted when I moved out there, they eventually ended up living a couple houses down from the house I had bought in Detroit. So their kids were frequent flyers at my house. They needed rides to school all the time. I just got really close with all of the kids. I got a call almost 3 years later after I'd been on her doorstep that the mom had had a severe asthma attack and passed away. And there were no dads in the home, obviously, still. And there were 7 kids at the time. And so we all passed the kids around. We had different kids at various homes. I had a couple living with me. They trashed my house. They were on my last nerve, but that wasn't what mattered at that time. They were loved and supported, and we were walking with them through this really, really tragic time. And so eventually, the aunt and uncle took guardianship of them, moved them out to the suburbs, and we continued to pour into them and support them and cheer them on. And a couple weeks ago, I got this picture in my Facebook messages of these two girls, the twins, graduated from high school with honors, and they're heading to nursing school. And their brother in the middle is a senior at Wayne State University on a football, full-ride football scholarship, and he'll graduate with a teaching degree this year as well. And so as a result of people not giving up and walking with them through the third and fourth eviction and through really tragic time, they've been able to continue to step forward and make progress. So while it's messy and while it's not always easy and it doesn't even make sense in our world, this is breaking the chains, and I believe that we can and we will do that in our community.
Thank you, Jesse. That preschool that she runs, they get is run out of another church. And so when that church was hiring for that position, they did a reference check on Jess and called me and had glowing things to say about her. But I did say, she can't go to church at your church. She's got to stay here. So as long as that gets taken care of, we are good. But just a tremendous resource that her life and her work is, and hopefully we all learned a lot today. It's the third Sunday of the month, so fittingly we are giving a benevolent offering while Jacob and the team come up here for Jacob's last song for us here at Hillcrest as well. But this offering is given to help people that we talked about today. And we give a lot of this offering to the community outreach, which is what Jesse, you know, was talking about with the Genesis Project. And they do a lot of the footwork for us to make sure that your donation and my donation goes to help people who have real verified needs. And so they do all that work. The people have to make the appointment. They have to make the call. They got to have some skin in the game, as Jess said. And your donation and mine goes to make sure that that happens. So I'm going to pray for this offering and then turn it over to Jacob as he closes out our service. Father, we thank you for today. I'm grateful for the work you're doing in and through our church as we're learning and as we're being challenged, as we're asking good questions and hearing great stories and considering what you have for us to do in helping people both here in our community and throughout the world who are under-resourced through no fault of their own. And so we, as we give this offering to you, we pray that you use these funds to help people here in our community with real needs. Father, I'm grateful for Jessie and for what she shared with us today and for the work that you've done in her life and in her family's life. And Father, as Jacob closes this morning, we're grateful for him as well. And we pray for his, or for your blessing on his future, and that we were able to have a part of his story when he looks back. Thank you so much for who he is and the gifting and the calling you have on his life. And we pray all these things in your name.